Okay, so now we're going to chant. And now we're going to chant Jai Radhamadhava, but there's no dancing. Jai Radhamadhava Kuli Hari, Jai Radhamadhava Kundabi Hari, Gopi Jana Malaba Kiri Baru Halti, Gopi Jana Malaba Kiri Baru Halti, Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana, Yashoda Nandana Rajajana Ranjana, Yamuna Tira Vanachari, Yamuna Tira Vanachari, Jaya Radhamadhuva Kunja Bihari, Jaya Radhamadhuva Ava Kunjabi Hari, Gopi Jana Malaba Kiri Bharat Ahuti, Gopi Jana Malaba Kiri Bharat Ahuti, Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana, Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana, Yamuna Tira Manachari, Yamuna Tira Manachari, Jaya Radha Madhuva Kunja Bihari, Jaya Radha Madhuva Kunja Bihari, Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Paramahamsa Also Teta Siddhashi Shimad, His Divine Grace of Ayachanana Bhaktipadana Goswami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, ISKCON Founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Ananta Koti Vaishnav Vrinda Ki Jai, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai, Prem Se Kaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda Shidvaita Gadadha, Shiva Siddhi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Shri Shri, Radha Krishna Gopinath Shyamkun Radhakunda Giri Gopardhan Ki Jai, Vrindavanam ki jai, Pancharam ki jai, Chagrata Sami ki jai, Yamunamai ki jai, Shrimati Lasi Devi ki jai, Vakta Vrindi ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bo. All glory is the assembled devotees, all glory is the assembled devotees, all glory is the assembled devotees. All glory is to Shri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Premananda. Nama Om Vishnupaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhute Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Namaste. I think I have to. There's too many people in Nuku'alofa who are on the network, so we're going to have to shut down the network for everybody else at this time because I can't afford to do my phone every day. So anyway, so we'll continue today, and tomorrow there'll have to be another solution for this. So, Omagana Timiranda Shah Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Unmiditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, who so kindly opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge while I was blinded in the darkness of ignorance. So, anyway, it's good to see everybody. Sorry for the network glitches. And we'll try our best to do it without any more glitches using our phone right now. So we're reading from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda, Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaur Bhaktivinoda, Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda, Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaur Bhaktivinoda, Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda, Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. So, good to see everybody. And so we'll go on to the Chaitanya Charitamrita. We're reading from the Adi Lila, chapter 2, in the middle of text 10's purport. So let's share the screen here. And this, of course, is a very philosophical part of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And there's not so many pastimes in this particular part, but this part is actually important, and I will be explaining things as we read along. So let's start here. The Lord is not directly attached to the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the material world, for he is eternally busy in the enjoyment of transcendental bliss with paraphernalia composed of his internal potencies. Yet as the initiator of the material energy, as well as the marginal potency of the living beings, he expands himself as the Purusha avatars who are invested with potencies similar to his. The Purusha avatars are also in the category of Bhagavat Tapta, Tattva, because each and every one of them is identical with the original form of the personality of Godhead. The living entities are his infinitesimal particles and are qualitatively one with him. They are sent into this material world for material enjoyment to fulfill their desires to be independent individuals, but still they are subject to the supreme will of the Lord. The Lord deputes himself in the state of supersoul to supervise the arrangements for such material enjoyment. The example of a temporary affair is quite appropriate in this connection. The citizens of a state assemble an affair to enjoy for a short period. The government deputes a special officer to supervise it. Such an officer is invested with all governmental power, and therefore he is identical with the government. When the affair is over, there is no need for such an officer, and he returns home. The Paramatma is compared to such an officer. Of course, also the Garbhadakshay Vishnu and the Paramatma are such officers. And the Mahavishnu, he continues to be manifest. Even at the time of the cosmic dissolution, the Mahavishnu is manifest with all the living entities who were previously in the cosmic creation are within his body. And when he creates the material universe again by breathing out, all the living entities come out and he implants them into the material energy through his glands. That's Saikshita. The Paramatma is compared to such an officer too. Living beings are not all in all. They are undoubtedly parts of the Supreme Lord and are qualitatively one with him, yet they are subject to his control. Thus, they are never equal to the Lord or one with him. The Lord who associates with the living being is the Paramatma, or the Supreme Living Being. No one, therefore, should view the tiny living beings and Supreme Being, living being, to be on an equal level. The all-pervading truth that exists eternally during the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of the material world in which the living beings rest in trance is called the impersonal Brahman. So next verse is a very important verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And of course it's in Sanskrit because it's from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And most of the devotees learn this verse, probably quoted it quite often. Vedanti tat tattva viras tattvam yad jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaneti shavyate. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth say that it is non-dual knowledge and it is called the impersonal Brahman, the localized paramatma and personality of Godhead. This Sanskrit verse appears as the 11th verse, the first canto, second chapter, Srimad Bhagavatam, where Sutta Goswami answers the questions of the sages headed by Shonaka Rishi, actually it's a Naimisharanya, concerning the essence of all scriptural injunctions. Tattva Vida refers to persons who have knowledge of the absolute truth. They can certainly understand knowledge without duality because they are on the spiritual platform. The absolute truth is known sometimes as Brahman, sometimes as Paramatma, and sometimes as Bhagavan. Persons who are in knowledge of the truth know that one who tries to approach the absolute simply by mental speculation will ultimately realize the impersonal Brahman, and one who tries to approach the absolute truth through yoga practice will be able to realize Paramatma, but one who has complete knowledge and spiritual understanding realizes the spiritual form of Bhagavan, the personality of God. And I'm going rather quickly through this since this is quite repetitive from one verse in purport to another. Devotees of the personality of Godhead know that Sri Krishna, the son of the king of Braja, is the absolute truth. They do not discriminate between Sri Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. One who wants to separate the Lord's absolute name, form, and qualities from the Lord himself must be understood to be lacking in absolute knowledge. A pure devotee knows that when he chants the transcendental name Krishna, Sri Krishna is present as transcendental sound. He therefore chants with full respect and veneration. When he sees the forms of Sri Krishna, he does not see anything different from the Lord. If one sees otherwise, he must be considered untrained in absolute knowledge. This lack of absolute knowledge is called Maya. One who is not Krishna conscious is ruled by the spell of Maya under the control of duality of knowledge. In the absolute, all manifestations of the Supreme Lord are non-dual, just as the multifarious forms of Vishnu, the controller of Maya, are non-dual. Empiric philosophers who pursue the impersonal Brahman accept only the knowledge that the personality of the living entity is not different from the personality of the Supreme Lord, and mystic yogis who try to locate the Paramatma accept only the knowledge that the pure soul is not different from the super soul. The absolute conception of a pure devotee, however, includes all others. A devotee does not see anything except in its relationship with Krishna, and therefore his realization is the most perfect of all. Okay, some Bengali here. Tanhara angera shuddha kirana mandal Upanishad kahe tanre brahma sunirmal. What the Upanishads call the transcendental personal Brahman is the realm of the glowing effulgence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Three mantras of the Mundaka Upanishad 2:2, 9:11 give information regarding the bodily effulgence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Here's the quote. Aranmaye parigoshe virajam brahma nishkalam tatshubram jyotisham jyotistat yad atma vido viduhu na yatra suryo vakti na chandra tarakam nema vidyuto vanti kuto yamagnihi tameva vantam anuvati sarvam tashabasa sarvamidam vivati Brahmai Vedam Amitam Purastad Brahma Paschad Brahma Dakshinatash Chotarena Adaschor Vamcha Prashritam Brahmai Vedam Vishwamidam Varishtam. In the spiritual realm, beyond material covering is the unlimited Brahman effulgence, which is free from material contamination. That effulgent white light is understood by transcendentalists to be the light of all lights. In that realm, there is no need of sunshine, moonshine, fire, or electricity for illumination. Verse from the Bhagavad Gita: "Natad basyate suryo, nasha shanko napavakaha, yadgatva nadivartante tadama paramamama." Indeed, whatever illumination appears in the material world is only a reflection of that supreme illumination. That Brahman is in front and back, in the north, south, east, and west, and also overhead and below. In other words, that supreme Brahman effulgence spreads throughout the material and spiritual worlds. Spiritual skies, okay. Charma shakshe deki aiche surya nirvishesh yanamarge laitinare krishnera vishesh. As with the naked eye, one cannot know the sun except as a glowing substance. Merely by philosophical speculation, one cannot understand Lord Krishna's transcendental varieties. And here's a verse from the Brahma Sangita. Yasha prabha prabhagato jagadanda koti kotishvasheshu vasudari vibhuti binam Tad Brahma Nishkalam Anantam Ashesha Bhutam Govindamadi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is endowed with great power. The glowing effulgence of his transcendental form is the impersonal Brahman, which is absolute, complete, and unlimited, and which displays the varieties of countless planets with their different opulences in millions and millions of universes. So this is a verse from the Brahma Samhita, the fifth chapter of Brahma Samhita, which all the verses we have are from the fifth chapter, text 40. Each and every one of the countless universes is full of innumerable planets with different constitutions and atmospheres. All these come from the unlimited non-dual Brahman or complete whole, which exists in absolute knowledge. The origin of that unlimited Brahman effulgence is the transcendental body of Govinda, who is offered respectful obeisances as the original and supreme personality of Godhead. Okay. Koti koti brahmandeye brahmera vibhuti se brahma govindera hayanga kanti. Lord Brahma said, the opulences of the impersonal Brahman spread throughout millions and millions of universes. That Brahman is but the bodily effulgence of Govinda. Now, the reason things are being repeated here, you may think right now, why am I hearing the same thing over and over and over and over again? Is because Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, in order to make his case about Krishna and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is presenting evidence. Now, evidence, as far as we are concerned, evidence is considered to be from the Vedic literatures. So different people accept different types of evidence. And now we're talking about epistemology. So we're going to talk about this for a second. Epistemology basically means, how do you know what you know? And in Jiva Goswami's Katwa Sandarbha, which is the first of all the Shat Sandarbhas, Jiva Goswami deals with epistemology. Like, what do we accept as an irrefutable source of knowledge? Now, some people say seeing is believing. But you can see something and believe in it, and it may not be real. If you're a mirage, or you cannot see something that is real. That's true. Happens all the time. People don't see something that is real. And so, therefore, as described, we have imperfect senses. But in any case, we don't accept evidence based upon what we perceive with the five senses, or even with the six senses, including the mind. The evidence that we see with those faculties, that evidence may be real, maybe not real. And so we don't take it as incontrovertible truth. Like, really, do you know, let's say you're perceiving, do you know you're in North Carolina? Yeah, we probably know we're in North Carolina. But it's not the absolute truth. Why do I say that? Because right now it's called North Carolina. A few hundred years ago, it wasn't called North Carolina. A few hundred years from now, it won't be called North Carolina like that. So it's not actually North Carolina. That's just a label that's been put on this land temporarily. So anyway, so those things that are tattvas that exist and continually exist, we consider those things to be real. So as far as knowledge of the absolute truth is concerned, everybody has their own opinion, but the Vedas give their, not just opinion, their version. That's why I say the Vedic version. And that's really important to understand, you know, what is the Vedic version? Why is the Vedic version perfect? Why? Dharmam tubakshakshad bhagavat pranitam. It comes from Krishna. Real dharma, or incontrovertible dharma, can only come from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It can't come just from any Joe Low, so to speak. It can't come from any just guy. It has to come from Krishna. So the Vedas are actually come from the breathing of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Srila Jiva Goswami in his Satsandarbha accepts the Srimad Bhagavatam as the ultimate source of knowledge. So in presenting different conclusions, the Vaishnavacharyas, including Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, who's the author of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, they present evidence just like a lawyer would present evidence from the law, from the law books. And he would actually quote, not only quote from the law books, but he would give the citation. Citation means it is present in this book, in this chapter, and in this page. That's called a citation. And that's what lawyers do. So we are spiritual lawyers. We are not simply speculating. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is not simply speculating. Oh, Lord Chaitanya is God. Well, sounds good. Just like you have some people who accept other people as God because they can produce some ashes from the air or so-called gold. Like Prabhupada said, maybe this bogus God can produce some gold, but Krishna is the producer of all the gold mine. So why is this bogus God collecting donations if he can actually produce gold? What's the need of collecting donations? You can even buy out Donald Trump if you wanted to. So therefore, we accept as incontrovertible evidence that which comes from the Vedas, and Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is giving us these citations, and that's why the citations are repetitive to prove the point. In the Brahma Samhita, it says this. In the Bhagavatam, it says this. In this other Shastra, it says this. In the Padma Purana, it says this. And that establishes the veracity of what he's saying. That's a spiritual lawyer. All right, let's continue. Segovinda bhajami teno moro pati tanhara prasade mora haya shrishti shakti. I worship Govinda. He is my Lord. Only by his grace am I empowered to create the universe. Although this is from Lord Brahma, of course. Although the sun is situated far away from the other planets, its rays sustain and maintain them all. Indeed, the sun diffuses its heat and light all over the universe. Similarly, the supreme sun, Govinda, diffuses his heat and light everywhere in the form of his different potencies. The sun's heat and light are non-different from the sun. In the same way, the unlimited potencies of Govinda are non-different from Govinda himself. Therefore, the all-pervasive Brahman is the all-pervasive Govinda. The Bhagavad Gita, in the 14th chapter, text 27, clearly mentions that the impersonal Brahman is dependent upon Govinda, and that is Brahmanohi Pratishtaham. I am the source of the impersonal Brahman, Krishna says. That is the real conception of the absolute truth. All right, here's another nice verse. Muniyo Vata Vasana Shamana Urva Mantinaha Pramatyam Dhamati Hanti Shanta Sanyasino Malaha. Naked saints and sannyasis who undergo severe physical penances, who can raise the cement of the brain, who are completely equal poison Brahman, can live in the realm known as Brahmaloka. In this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, it's from the 11th canto, 6th chapter, text 47. But the Vasanaha means mendicants who have given up, you know, you understand, who do not care anything about anything material, including clothing, but who depends wholly on nature. Such sages do not cover their bodies even in severe winter or scorching sunshine. They take great pains not to avoid any kind of bodily suffering, and they live by begging from door to door. They never discharge their semen, either knowingly or unknowingly. By such celibacy, they're able to raise the semen to the brain. Thus, they become most intelligent and develop very sharp memories. Their minds are never disturbed or diverted from contemplation on the absolute truth, nor are they ever contaminated by desire for material enjoyment. By practicing austerities under strict discipline, such mendicants attain a neutral state transcendental to the modes of nature and merge into the impersonal Brahman. So in other words, by doing all those things and being so austere, all they get to do is go to the impersonal Brahman and remain asleep for some time. You know, I can think of better ways of sleeping than going to the impersonal Brahman. So don't get any ideas when you read this particular verse. In fact, if one really wants to attain perfection, especially Krishna conscious perfection, which is what we're interested in, there's a very nice verse in the instructions of Jad Bharat to Maharaj Rahugana. Jad Bharat says, says, turn off my phone. That's what Jad Bharat says. Sorry about that. Let's go back to what we were doing. You know, even we had trouble with the phone internet for a second. I apologize to everyone for that, but it is not my fault. It definitely is not my fault. Hold on a second. We'll do a screen share again. Thank you all for being so tolerant of the internet vagaries. Okay, so here is where we left off, as far as I know, when we dropped off. We're talking about austerities and penances. So there's an interesting verse, and if you heard this before, I'm just backtracking a little bit. There was an interesting verse spoken by Jadabar to King Rahugana in light of what we just read in the purport. And in this verse, it says, Rahuganai tat tapasad na yati na chejiya nirvak. My dear King Rahugana, no one can become self-realized by, let's see, immersing themselves in fire in the middle of the summer, or putting them in ice cubes in the middle of the winter, nor by taking sannyas, nor by being a good rahasta. None of these things will make one Krishna conscious. And he gives the secret for becoming Krishna conscious. He says, Chandasana Ivajalagnisar, Vanamahadpada Rajobi Shekham, only by taking the dust of the feet of a great pure devotee can one become Krishna conscious. And that's the easy way. You don't have to execute any severe austerities. You just take the dust. How do you take the dust of a great, the feet of a great pure devotee? Guru Mukha Padma, you listen and you do, and you take into your heart, as we quoted the other day from Lord Kapila Dev's instruction, Bhavanti Ridkarna Rasayana Kata, Tajoshana Dashu Abhavargavartmani Shuddha Ratiya Bhakti Nukramashati. Let's continue. Antaryami Anari Yoga Shastrikai Seha Govindera Angsha Vibhutiye Hoy. He was described in the Yoga Shastras as the indwelling supersoul. Atma Antaryami is also plenary portion of Govinda's plenary personal expansion. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is by nature joyful, and the word is Anandamoya Vyasat. His enjoyments of pastimes are completely transcendental. He is in the fourth dimension of existence. For although the material world is measured by the limitations of length, breadth, and height, the Supreme Lord is completely unlimited in his bodily form and existence. He is not personally attached to any of the affairs within the material cosmos. The material world is created by the expansion of his Purusha avatars, who direct the aggregate material energy and all the conditioned souls. By understanding the three expansions of the Purusha, a living entity can transcend the position of knowing only the 24 elements of the material world. Now, here Prabhupada is referring to Sankhya philosophy. And Sankhya means counting, in which one analyzes the 24 material elements, beginning with earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego, then the senses and the active senses and the perceptive senses and the sense objects, form, taste, smell, etc., like that. And then ultimately, you get to the soul, the super soul. One of the expansions of Mahavishnu is Shirodakshai Vishnu, the super soul within every living entity. Of course, Mahavishnu first expands as Garbhadakshai Vishnu, then as Shirodakshai Vishnu, as the super soul of the total aggregate of living entities, or the second Purusha. He is known as Garbhadakshay Vishnu, as the creator or original cause of innumerable universes, or the first Purusha, who is lying in the causation. He's called Mahavishnu. The three Purushas direct the affairs of the material world. So that's Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshay Vishnu, and Shirodakshay Vishnu. Mahavishnu breathes out all the universes and plants the living entities within each and every universe. The Garbhadakshay Vishnu lies down within each and every universe and gives birth to Lord Brahma, and the Shirodakshay Vishnu, which expands from the Garbhadakshay Vishnu, enters into each and every atom and each and every heart, and is all pervasive, and also lies down and it's in the Shiradaksha, Vishnu is lying down in the ocean of transcendental milk. The authorized scriptures direct the individual souls to revive their relationship with the super soul. Indeed, the system of yoga is the process of transcending the influence of the material elements by establishing a connection with the Purusha known as Paramatma. One who has thoroughly studied the intricacies of creation can know very easily that this Paramatma is the plenary portion of the Supreme Person, Supreme Being, Sri Krishna. Like I said, it is repetitive. Ananta Svatike Yaiche Eka Surya Vase Tache Jiva Govindera Angsha Prakashe. As the one sun appears reflected in countless jewels, so Govinda manifests himself as Paramatma in the hearts of all living beings. The sun is situated in a specific location, but is reflected in countless jewels and appears in innumerable localized aspects. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although eternally present in this transcendental abode, Goloka Vrindavan, is reflected in everyone's heart as the super soul. In the Upanishads, it is said that the jiva, living entity, and Paramatma, super soul, like two birds sitting in the same tree. The super soul engages the living being in executing fruitive work as a result of his deeds in the past, but the Paramatma has nothing to do with such engagements. As soon as the living being ceases to act in terms of fruitive work and takes to the service of the Lord, the Paramatma, coming to know of his supremacy, that is, the Paramatma knows of his supremacy, but the Lord, the individual soul knows of his supremacy, he is immediately freed from all designations, and in that pure state, he enters the kingdom of God known as Vaikuntha. So the super soul, just to expand a little bit, the super soul engages the living entity according to his karma and according to his desire. Two things work together, karma and desire. And the example I commonly give is if one, let's say, very much wants to eat nicely, that's desire, but doesn't have good karma, then he takes the body of a pig. And if one wants to eat nicely and has good karma, then he'll take the body of an Epicurean human being. That means a human being who wants the pig out. The Paramatma or super soul, the guide of the individual living beings, does not take part in fulfilling the desires of the living entity, but he arranges for their fulfillment by material nature. As soon as an individual soul becomes conscious of his eternal relationship with the super soul and looks only towards him, he at once becomes free from the entanglements of material nature. Christian philosophers who do not believe in the law of karma put forward the argument that it is absurd to say that one must accept the results of past deeds of which he has no consciousness. A criminal is first reminded of his misdeeds by witnesses in a law court, and then he is punished. If death is complete forgetfulness, why should a person be punished for his past misdeeds? Very good question. The conception of the Paramatma is an invincible answer to these fallacious arguments. The Paramatma is the witness of the past activities of the individual living being. A man may not remember what he has done in his childhood, but his father, who has seen him grow through different stages of development, certainly remembers. Similarly, the living being undergoes many changes of body through many lives. But the super soul is always with him and remembers all of his activities despite his evolution through different bodies. And let me unpack that a little bit more. So you may say, the super soul remembers, but I don't remember what I did bad, so why am I getting punished? Well, here's the explanation. You may not remember, that's true. Consciously, you may not remember, but you still have those same propensities or proclivities. And because you have those same propensities and proclivities, those are what the punishment is meant to deal with. That's really important. Because here we are talking about the subtle body, not just the gross body. The subtle body has the memories, the impressions. We call them what? Samskaras from many past births. So the way to get rid of samskaras or to help you realize, to be more precise, that those scars are really problematic. There is sometimes punishment or reward. But that's why punishment is there. You get punished for things you don't remember, but subtly, in the subtle body, there is some remembrance. There's the impression there. There's propensity. There's the proclivity. And so the punishment is meant to help you deal with that propensity or proclivity. So like a thief, an habitual thief, may not remember precisely when he stole a particular object. For example, let's say a thief has stolen 1,000 times different things. And you tell him, well, do you remember when you stole that diamond from Mr. Jones? And the thief won't remember. Not necessary for him to remember in order for him to get rectified. Because the whole purpose of punishment is not to punish. Or it's not for the sake of punishment. It's like in this world, there's two theories of justice. One theory is retributive justice. The other theory is restorative justice. And let me explain what I mean by that. Retributive justice means that you send someone to jail or punish them in different ways to make them suffer. So you get even with them. Now, some people believe in it, but that's not the law of how the law of God is applied or karma is applied. Karma is applied in a restorative sense. So even in this world, there are some people who work in the penal system, that means the prison system, if you don't know, who employ the philosophy of restorative justice. Restorative justice means we want to bring someone to the proper frame of consciousness. In other words, it really doesn't matter if they remember what they did with restorative justice. The whole point of restorative justice is to bring people to the functional, honest stage of life in the material world. You understand? Because they're habitual thief, they're habitual drugs, taker or whatever it is. And so we want to reform them. And the punishment is just meant to reform. So with the law of karma, that's what Krishna and his material energy are doing. They're reforming people. So it's not punishment for punishment's sake. It's punishment for reform, or reward for reform, or reaction for reform. Because when you understand the whole purpose of the material energy, and the study of purposes is called teleology, which means basically the study of purposes, like biology is the study of bio, which means life, of course. Like we mentioned before, epistemology is the study of how do you know what you know. So teleology is the study of what are the purposes like that. So what is the purpose of this world? And the atheists, they say that this world has no purpose. In fact, Krishna actually talks about this in the Gita. He's simply born, Krishna says, of sex desire. In other words, just the interaction of the material elements because of attraction, repulsion, etc., like that. But there is a purpose in this world. And the purpose of this world, like the purpose of a good prison, is to reform the prisoners. We are all prisoners. And so whatever happens to us, that is the reason for those things that happen to us, whether we're devotees or not devotees. Now, the difference is, if one's a devotee, it's directly Krishna. And if one is not a devotee, then it is not directly Krishna. It is Krishna's material energy, which is carrying out the function of rectification. But in both cases, it's rectification. Rectifying. Ultimately bringing someone to the point of understanding what? I don't belong here in this material world. ultimately bringing someone to the point of surrendering to Guru and Krishna. Bring someone to the point of taking up pure devotional service and going back to the spiritual world and becoming an honest soul. Right now we are dishonest souls in this world. Okay. So at this particular point, we're going to take questions. The next verse is text 20, and that text is from the Bhagavad Gita. Some of you may recognize it, but we'll go over that tomorrow. And hopefully the internet will work better tomorrow. So let us take some questions. I'm sorry for the glitches in the internet that we experienced today. We'll try to do something. I've been trying to get an alternative internet connection, which I may have by tomorrow. Okay, so you're allowed to unmute yourself now. So who has a question or a comment or a problem? Okay, Madhava, you have a question.
Yes, Maharaj. So I'm sorry, I'm going back. I have two questions. One, going back to verse number one in this chapter, we are. So it talked about, okay, actually, I'm just stating this, that the philosophy of Buddha, argumentative presentation of the Jnani yoga system of Patanjali, Gautama, and the systems of philosophy like Kannada, Kapila, and Dattatreya are dangerous, right, creation. There's danger in the creatures in the ocean of nonsense. So how to understand this? Lord Kapila is in Bhagavatam, he's teaching that philosophy, but why it is, say, it is dangerous? How to understand this?
Okay. So the explanation for that is that there are two Kapila Devs.
Okay.
Prabhupada explains there's an atheist Kapila Dev and there's a theist who is an incarnation or expansion of Krishna. So the one that, okay, is mentioned there is the atheist. So that's how, okay, to understand.
Okay, I got it.
Prabhupada explains that in the Srimad Bhagavatam and in other places too.
Okay. Then thank you, Maharaj. So second question is that you were talking about that subtle body. So is made up of mind, intelligence, and false ego, right? Is that right?
Right. Yeah, the subtle chair.
So, and of course, super soul also carries, never leaves even the subtle body. So, so that remembers that subtle body, past activities, but how this body, present body, also has mind and intelligence and ego. So how come this does not remember, where the subtle body remembers the impression of the activities, okay, done here?
Yeah, so this gross body we have, you're talking about Panchamahabhuta. The, yeah, subtle body, first of all, the subtle body of mind, intelligence, false ego, it's called the Linga Shavira or astral body, is carried from one lifetime to another by the soul. And Krishna describes in the Gita, it's like the air carries an aroma from one lifetime to another. So, but we don't remember the specific instances from one lifetime to another because of the change of gross bodies. That is the Panchamahabhuta, earth, water, fire, air, ether. It's because of the change of gross bodies, just like you may have, okay, here's an example. You may have it in your computer, the memory, you may have certain memory, but when your computer is broken, you may not be able to access that memory. The memory is still there, but you're not able to access it. So sometimes through hypnotism or other means, people can access the memories that are there from past lives, or you can figure out something about your past lives from astrology. But it's not the way Krishna has arranged everything. It's not really manifest through the gross body unless Krishna makes a special adjustment. For example, in the case of Bhart Maharaj, who became a deer, he was able to remember his past life because Krishna made that arrangement. But generally, even we experience in this lifetime, for example, that many things happen to us that we forget. And then sometimes, let's say if we're hypnotized or something, we can remember something that happened in our childhood or in our dreams. We may remember something that happened in our childhood, but consciously we're not remembering these things. In other words, even the scientists even talk about the consciousness and the subconsciousness. And so when you get to the really subconsciousness, that is what's the subtle body with the remembrances or the impressions from past lifetimes. That's why when we chant Hare Krishna, it's an interesting phenomenon. It's a good question you're asking. When we chant Hare Krishna, it actually dissolves the impressions or many of the impressions we had from past lifetimes. Prabhupada one time was talking about that when you dream at night, he said you may dream of gold and you may dream of a mountain because you have experienced those things in the past and then you put them together as a gold mountain, which doesn't actually exist. So Prabhupada said sometimes in dreams that things from your past lifetime can come out. But the chanting of the holy name, those are called samskaras, of course, and the chanting of the holy name actually can dissolve those particular samskaras. Cheto Dharpanam Arjunam, we say, cleanses the mirror of the mind or the mirror of the heart. Cheto Dharpanam Arjunam Baba Mahadvagni Nirvapanam. So the gross body is a filter through which the consciousness becomes manifest. And I'm going to explain that further. Just like a light filter is a filter, and also the subtle body is a filter, so it's doubly filtered. Our consciousness is doubly filtered. So just like you may have a light, a pure white light, and then the pure white light is filtered through one filter, let's say a blue filter, and then it's filtered through another filter, you know, hopefully it's partially blue, and the light becomes further blocked. Do you understand that, Madhava?
Yes, Maharaj, yes.
So that our consciousness is blocked filtered both by our subtle body and by our gross body. And the gross body doesn't allow, or the change of gross bodies doesn't permit us to remember at least clearly who we were, what we were doing in our past lives.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, who else has a question?
Hare Krishna Gurudev, Dandavat Pranam.
Ah, okay. Radha Padma, you really changed. You look like Nalini Kant, but actually, yeah, your name's Radha Padma. So, what's up?
Gurudev, there are three questions, but so one who suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder, they do have nightmares and night terrors, although it is from this life, and other people
sometimes from past lives. That's why, for example, someone may have a phobia. You know what a phobia is?
Yes, fear from.
Yeah, claustrophobia. You're afraid of like really small space. If you get in an elevator, you just like go crazy, or you're afraid. There's a phobia. You're afraid of water. Aquaphobia. You're afraid of heights, and I forget the exact word for height phobia, but you're afraid of heights, and there's no possible explanation of anything that happened to you in this lifetime. That's, of course, you're having PTSD.
So chanting can cure that, Gurudev?
Chanting and experiences in this world. Huh. I mean, for example, when I was very young, I had this phobia of spiders.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just look at a dark place and actually start to shake in fear of spiders. I mean, so obviously that's, I mean, I never got hurt by a spider my whole life. Never. And some people are afraid of snakes. Some people are afraid of spiders. And now, you know, by chanting Hare Krishna, I pick up spiders and I play with them all the time. Because not in Australia. In Australia, they have these spiders called the red-back spiders. One time I was in someone's house in, I think it was Sydney, and I looked at my arm and it was covered by all these red-back spiders. And I didn't freak out. I just asked them all to get off. No, actually, I brushed them off. And fortunately, none of them bit me, and they're very dangerous spiders. So anyway, I'm not afraid of spiders anymore. But when I was young, you know, just a little baby, I had a great fear of spiders. So these things come from past lives or this life.
Yes.
Or this life too.
So impressions can be dissolved by chanting.
Yeah. By chanting. Of course, the psychologists, they try to dissolve these impressions in terms of the post-traumatic stress disorder by exposure, by desensitization. You're probably aware of that.
Yes.
You know, if you're very much afraid of snakes, then they'll have you play with snakes for several days. Not in Australia, of course. Australia has the most dangerous snakes in the world. But anywhere else, like when I was young, my mother would take me regularly to the Serpentarium. And the Serpentarium was a place where they had serpents. Imagine taking your poor little boy to see snakes. So anyway, so that's one way the psychologists deal with it, but we deal with it by chanting. Because not only do we have post-traumatic stress, when we're subjected to things that may cause us to be fearful or put us in anxiety, but we also have post-attraction too, because of conditioning. Yes. Like we're attracted to certain things. We have to understand that's conditioning. Yeah. Like for example, we had one devotee here, she joined the movement, many, many years ago. She joined the movement, but her conditioning was attraction to skiing. You know, so when it came time for the skiing season, I mean snow skiing, for those of you who don't know what snow is, it's white stuff that falls from the sky. Anyway, so when it came time for the skiing season, she just like lost her mind and went crazy. She knew it was Maya, but she just like can't stand it anymore. She ran to the mountains and started skiing. So that there's post-attraction too, as well as post-traumatic stress. It's based upon impressions on the subtle body. Conditioning, it's called condition. That's why we're called conditioned souls. We're conditioned to have certain responses. I mean, like, you're familiar with Pavlov, right?
Yes, Gurudev.
Pavlov was a psychologist, and he actually conditioned animals to salivate at a certain time when they heard a bell. You know, first he would feed them every time he rang the bell, and after a while he stopped feeding them, he just rang the bell, and they also salivated at the same time. So we're conditioned. That's why we're called conditioned souls. We're conditioned, first of all, to turn our face away from Krishna. We're conditioned to be attracted to certain sense objects. That's like you'll find certain people who are addicted to certain things. You know, sometimes people are addicted to liquor, sometimes people are addicted to other types of intoxication. Sometimes people are addicted to things on the internet. Sometimes people are addicted to football.
Food.
Or in India, they're addicted to cricket, right?
Yes.
It's conditioning. For example, I am not, I was never attracted to cricket because I wasn't conditioned to be attracted to cricket. So that's the impressions on the subtle body. Whereas I don't think I'm attracted to any sports, but anyway. But you find, just like I was reading that generally the president of the United States, frankly, all of those people, they're conditioned to play golf, right?
Yes.
Which is actually one of the stupidest games on the planet. Prabhupada actually said that. Prabhupada said that when he asked, what is golf? Devotees were explaining to him actually what a sand trap was, what golf was. And Prabhupada said they're simply trying to forget Krishna because they keep hitting a ball until it goes into a hole. It's pretty stupid. If you think about it, you take a club and you keep hitting the ball, and whoever hits it the least amount of times wins. I mean, all these games are stupid, but you're conditioned. That's why you may like cricket, and I don't, because you're conditioned to like cricket by your experiences in your childhood or past life or whatever it is. And I always tell that funny story of how when I was going around Govardhan one time, the kids were actually, you know, making fun of me. And I was able to stop them from making fun of me when I explained to them that I was an Australian cricket star who was praying to Krishna, praying to Govardhan for success at my next cricket game. So that's conditioning. So that's a really like easy way to understand condition. So we're conditioned to respond to certain stimuli. And so to become Krishna conscious means to become unconditioned. That's why we're called conditioned souls. We're trained. It's like a dog. You know, a dog is trained to do different tricks, or a dolphin or some animal is trained to do different tricks. So we're actually conditioned by Krishna's illusory message, energy. I'm just looking at a message. Someone sent me the wrong message that was meant for someone else. And she was brains elsewhere, but I didn't even understand the message. Anyway, so we are conditioned souls. So the whole idea of chanting is to become unconditioned. Cheto Darpana Marjanam Bhava Mahad Bhagni Nirvapanam, which actually cleanses the conditioning or cleanses the heart. And so we can see things as they actually are. Okay? What other questions? One more question you get.
Gurudev. Oh, yes. Thank you, Gurudev. Dattatreya philosophy. My understanding was Dattatreya means Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh, as we learned as a child.
Yes.
I don't know much about it. It's like follow-up question from Madhava Prabhu's question, where he mentioned about Dattatreya philosophy, how it is dangerous.
Dattatreya is the actual name, Dattatreya.
Okay.
Because he didn't directly point out the pure devotional service of the Lord. Even Srila Vyasadeva was chastised when he compiled the Mahabharata without directly pointing out the direct service of the Lord. So even perfect self-realization philosophy without pointing out Krishna consciousness is imperfect. So that's the point. So even though someone may point out something like you're not the body or whatever, if they don't connect that with Krishna consciousness or the knowledge of the absolute, that actually is dangerous. And Srila Vyasadeva got chastised by his guru Narada Muni for doing that.
Yeah.
The Bhagavatam verse. Whoops, what's that noise? There's a Bhagavatam verse that actually states that even spiritual knowledge when devoid of a conception of the absolute is condemned. even if it's spiritual knowledge devoid of conception of the absolute personality of God. Okay, it's time to end. Thank you so very much.
That means in Quran or in Bible, it is also dangerous, Gurudev?
I mean, if it's Bible it's dangerous if you accept it as the complete explanation of the absolute truth. If you accept it as just as a stepping stone, but not everything. The Bible talks about God.
Yeah,
there's God, he's the creator. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But any knowledge that's devoid of conception of the absolute, of the personality of God, at least some conception, is actually dangerous.
Thank you, Guru.
That's in the Bible is dangerous because it has some conception of the absolute supreme personality of God, and so does the Quran.
Yeah.
It's not that every religious person has to understand Krishna. They can understand Lord Vishnu or other expansions of the supreme personality of God.
Yes.
Yeah, there's many different Vaishnava Sampradayas. There's four Vaishnava Sampradayas, but there's many different devotees who worship different forms of the Absolute. As long as they understand that God is a person, our objection is with impersonalism or the presentation of spiritual knowledge which is devoid of conception of a personal God.
Yes.
And there's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, and I don't have the exact quote about it, but you can look it up. You know, knowledge devoid of the conception of a personal God is condemned. Okay?
Thank you, Gurudev.
All right, thank you. All glorious to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.